Well, g'day guys, and welcome to a brand new show put out here by the Kingdom Business Podcast. This one's called Check the News. And the whole purpose here is to look at global business news. We'll look at Australia, we'll look at the UK, we'll be looking at obviously the US, and we'll be having a discussion through the lenses of how does this fit with the kingdom and can we have a little bit of fun with it. Make sure you subscribe to the channel because that's how we can help this explode. That's how we can get it out to more people. That's how we can have a greater impact. Our whole motivation, though, is to start to reframe the world's news through the lenses of the kingdom and put Jesus back at the center of the marketplace. So I have two very esteemed gentlemen, older than me, to be fair, on the show with me. These are great guys that I've walked quite a bit of a journey with over the past 10 plus years. And I massively respect both of them in their field. The three of us are all quite different. You know, the guys will introduce themselves in a second, but Dave Balestri, he's from New South Wales of Australia. And he is bivocational, which basically means that he's a businessman, but he's also an incredibly gifted pastor slash prophet. And he definitely approaches things quite differently. We also have Mark Bilton, also from New South Wales. And Mark is he's got an incredible history of being a high-level CEO in some really large organizations. And his ability to kind of dissect what's going on and map it out in, you know, at big scale is inspiring. And I am just your small business guy who loves to be messy and scrappy and bootstrap a business to get it to work. So between us, it should be a good conversation. All right, Dave, why don't you give us the 1 minute on who you are?
Sure, thank you. Hey, welcome. I'm a granddad, husband, granddad, four children. I've got kids everywhere. I need a bigger house. And then in my spare time, I run a consultancy company, mentoring CEOs and business people, just in helping them to stay spiritual, attuned into their kingdom assignments in their businesses, and then also and part of a great church here on the Central Coast, New South Wales, called Hope Unlimited Church, where I have the honour to serve alongside Pastors Mark and Darlene Check and a whole bunch of great people, and just loving the bivocational space.
Great. Mark.
Hey, Wes. Thanks for the invite. I'm not sure about the comment about being old. I clocked up 60 last year, so I'm a little bit sensitive still as far as, the age question. This is my post-corporate life. So for the last 7 or 8 years, I've had a leadership advisory practice. So I work with kind of mid-level entrepreneurs around the 100 million kind of revenues. So you get them started and get them up and running. If they're successful, they come to me and we'll take them to the next level. And I love that. So it's spending time with leaders, that's the passion. So we help them with strategy, leadership, culture, and I've been putting advisory boards together as well. So that's lead well, live well. And then I have another thing where I help the body of Christ think about faith and work. And that's called the Monday Movement. And that involves, I've got some books and some courses, and just help people wrestle with, is God interested in my work? And if he is, how do we actually activate that? And I'm married to Helen, been married to Helen for 35 years, and I have three adult children who've all left home. So I am not like you with a whole bunch of kids running around. I'm not a grandfather yet. I don't think I'm quite ready to be a grandfather, but three adult children, they all left home about 3 years ago.
You're not old enough to be a granddad yet, Mark.
Yeah, I'm not in a hurry.
Cool. All right. So anyway, we'll flash up all your handles so people can go find you, right? Because that's just a cool part of doing all of this. All right. So we're here to talk about global news and have a little bit of fun with it. The first story I want to pick up on is Tiger Woods and Nike are splitting up, right? It's been 27 years partnership. And I mean, you know, some people made some serious money in that partnership over 27 years. I don't know that I fact checked this, but I think Tiger was the first person to get a $1 million endorsement in his first year from Nike. And obviously that was massive dollars 27 years ago, right? But I'm keen to hear from you guys, like why do you think that's come to an end? And what do you think that means for Nike, and what do you think it means for Tiger? Because they've both obviously got a massive bright future. Then they're not stopping. What does it mean for golf? So Maybe Mark, like, what are your thoughts? What does all of this mean?
I remember being in a hotel watching the Masters. Not really a golf fan, but watching Tiger Wood win the Masters, and the kind of the countercultural. You know, it was a big white bastion institution, and Tiger Woods winning that and breaking down a whole bunch of barriers was just a phenomenal event. And he's just an incredible athlete, whether you know, like golf or not, and massively successful at that. And just such a rigorous example of dedication and discipline. I remember hearing about him winning a tournament and then going back to practice because there was one shot that he just didn't get quite right, and he's still sort of in practicing rather than celebrating. So an incredible athlete and a great demonstrator of someone who can bring a lot of discipline. Look, as far as his sponsorship is concerned, yes, he was right. I think at the time when he got his early sponsorship, he was the most valued athlete in any sport. It was phenomenal. Do you remember that one where the ball just literally rolls into the cup and it's got the Nike swoosh just as it drops into the cup? You couldn't make up a better marketing campaign, even if you tried. But you know, things move on. Tiger is not the force that he used to be. I don't think he ever will be. Nike are not as interested in golf as they were. They've dropped clubs and balls, I think, as well. They're just doing some clothing. So look, I think things come to a natural end. He's passed his ascendancy. I think Nike's commitment to golf has passed as well, and things move on.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I also think Nike would be strategic here. Why would they continually back a guy that's nearing the end of his tenure? Like they could right now take the amount of money they're paying him and probably find 15 younger people coming through and hedge their bets, right? And run another 27 years. So, you know, from Nike's point of view, and the article doesn't say who, you know, they both kind of walked away is what it says, but it would have been led by somebody. But I can't imagine, you know, Nike, who are fighting so hard for the market they're in, you know, they're going to want to back the next winner. They don't want to ride one old donkey until the sunset, right? So strategically, they could take the big bucks they're paying him and distribute it, you know, to a younger generation. David, what do you reckon?
Yeah. I think the ambassadorship dimension is really important. And, you know, I mean, okay, yes, Tiger and Nike's been one of those standout deals that has worked, I think, for both parties. I mean, Nike would have backed 1,000 other people hoping they would have turned into a Tiger. And so I think you're right. I think they're hedging their bets. He's at the end. They're looking strategically the next 20 years. You're right. They've taken that bag of cash. My take is they've taken that bag of cash. They've got their scouts out. They're looking for Tiger 2.0 or, you know, to Mark's point, I agree. I don't see them as prevalent in the golf space. I think there are other avenues, other sports that are going to emerge really strongly over the next 20 years that I'm not saying golf is going away, but, you know, there's other opportunities. I think ambassadorship and sponsorship like that only works when it's a win-win. It's got to work for the champion and it's got to work for the brand. And so when that's no longer there, you know, don't keep on prodding it up because it's not going to give you the return.
There was a lot of speculation that Tiger would go to the Swiss shoe brand or the Swiss brand On, which are absolutely dominating globally right now, like dominating. But they've put that to bed and said he's not. But I think that it speaks to an interesting point. Everybody's trying to ride the coattails of the next thing, right?
Yeah.
So actually, and it's both ways. Like Nike are trying to ride the Tiger, and the Tiger's trying to ride the Nike, right? Like, and I think the public perception for a lot of this stuff is, you know, the brands get on well and they're united. No, these are just commercial decisions, right? At the end of the day, they're just commercial decisions that say, you know, will this give us a lot more exposure? Because Nike could have found a different golfer and spent the money on newspaper ads, right? But it literally just decided that partnering with Tiger was the best way to go, right? So, So, you know, you pick any sport and any brand, and it is literally just a commercial decision that says, we think this way will get us more reach. And the minute it doesn't, you know, like we're out. So yeah. if you take Nike and Michael Jordan, right, they still, they have a lot more of a cemented relationship in terms of business partners because of the, you know, the Jumpman brand is co-owned. But that's still going, right? Why? Yeah. Because basketball is still far more at the center of culture than golf. More at the center of culture than golf, right? You know?
So, yeah, Wes, I think there's it's an interesting dynamic when great athletes get into maturity and start to go in decline. How does a brand handle that? I mean, they can still draw a crowd. Like if Tiger Woods is playing on the local course, you know, it'd still bring a massive crowd, but he's not going to be considered a high-performance athlete as far as winning tournaments anymore. Even Hamilton, I think, in Formula One, you know, moving out of Mercedes, no longer champion. Is he still a good driver? Probably. Could he still win? I don't know. Jury's out, right? So, but he's going to Ferrari next year. That's a big call for him, having been wedded to Mercedes for so long. And I think it's the same sort of dynamic.
And he went public with or drive with Mercedes until the day he dies, like 5 years ago.
He did, yeah. But he's always wanted to ride. He's always, you know, the red car. He can't beat the red car, right?
So you can beat the red car. You can get in a Red Bull again, and then
always wanted to be there.
I think that's his only chance of winning again is if he's in a Red Bull car.
They've got their challenges at the moment too with their boss and all sorts of trouble, Christian Horner.
Yep. Well, you're a lot closer to that world because you love the fanfare. But, you know, like another brand deal that I'm convinced has happened and maybe hasn't, but I'm convinced it has, would be, like I'm pretty sure that Taylor Swift went to the NFL and said, I need exposure in the NFL. Yeah. I need you to pick somebody. I need you to pick somebody to be my next boyfriend. I don't care who it is. I just need to sign a deal with the NFL so that I can penetrate a new market.
Very cynical, Wes. Very, very cynical.
Well, you know, based on, you know, history and songs, like, cause obviously, you know, like, you know, Travis is a good guy and he just happens to be winning at the minute. So they picked a good one. But those brand deals are important. That's how you get into a market, right? Is you get into a market like that. You know, I can't imagine too many hardcore, tough football players are Swifties, right? With their lanyards all up their arm, but they will be now, right? They will be now. Incredibly commercial for her to latch onto the NFL. So,
I mean, I think at this point, these companies are trying to sell something more than a product or even a game. They're selling a dream, an image, and the best way to embody that image is with flesh and blood people, even if they're airbrushed and, you know, everything's managed, you know, even to the degree that you're, you know, suggesting there, you know, was the partnership or the relationship a deal. I mean, we like to think the world's black and white. It's just not. You know, it's just not. And anybody that believes anything that they're hearing from mainstream media or these mainstream outlets is just not living in the real world, living in the matrix, I think, that these big corporate, big tech have created. And so that really does, I mean, part of it, I've said to many people, don't watch the news and don't watch media. You've got to, as a kingdom person, you've got to discern it. You've got to discern it. And I'm not saying this is different from any other age or generation, but without doubt, you know, it's complex and it's not as clear cut as everybody thinks it is. So,
How do we take all of that and make it relevant to a smaller business guy? Like how does somebody do brand deals? Like if they are a smaller business?
Well, I think the power of partnerships is good. Power of product placement, I think, is really important as well. You know, if you're next to, if your product's a premium brand and you're next to a great champagne and a nice car with an attractive model, you know, you get a lot of the situational and brand prominence just leaks into your brand. So I think partnerships are really important. And those can go horribly wrong too. You know, if you connect yourself with a brand that suddenly comes unstuck. And the power of social media these days, as far as the ability to grow and demolish a brand or people or CEOs, can be pretty powerful.
Mm. Yeah.
So good. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I feel like influence and eyeballs during COVID became really centralized. Like it was almost like all eyeballs went to like a handful of people, right? You saw The Rock go from, 100 million to 240 million followers on Instagram during COVID, because there were certain people that just went, hang on, everyone's on their phones right now. Let's double down, right? Mm-hmm. The UFC would be another example. The UFC just decided, they kept going, right? Their sport kept going all the way through COVID because they built Fight Island and that. Yeah. But they just decided, well, hang on a minute, everyone's on their phones. Let's 50x the amount of content we're putting out, and let's just absolutely, and you saw them. But since then, I think there's been a decentralization, right? Where people are like, all right, well, the little influencer with 9,000 Instagram, like we'll give them some of our attention instead of everybody looking at a handful of people. And I think that trend of decentralizing, because on the topic of brand deals, we used to look up to a handful of people, but I think brands these days are taking their budget and distributing it amongst a much larger group of people, because they're like, well, that person may only have 9,000 or 30,000 or 15,000, but they've got a really loyal 15,000. And so we could give that person, $1,000 a month and infiltrate that world. And I reckon that's going to keep going. I mean, influencer marketing is the term for it. The problem is that influencer marketing has been boom and bust for 15 years, right? It's all based on an algorithm. But the trend of taking big budgets and distributing it to much smaller budgets that have more loyal audiences, all brands can do that. Because to Mark's point, we can do partnerships and collaboration. We don't have to partner with Nike. We could partner with a lot of small local partnerships that give our brand a whole bunch of uplift.
Yeah. I mean, Wes, you're the scale king as far as helping SMEs, push into this space. I don't know. For me, I find I like the fact that I want to scale as well with regards to the message and everything else, but I don't necessarily mass market myself. My message is quite defined. And while I've got not necessarily that mass following, the ones that do are very engaged and buy into everything that I'm, presenting, putting out, all that sort of stuff. So I think, because you asked, well, how can an SME jump in on this? Then I just think it's tricky. I don't think it's just splash the cash and see what works. I think you've got to put some thought into it. There's definitely a sequence here or a strategy that needs to be more than just, I'll put the bottle of champagne in the flashy car next to the product.
I agree with you, David. I think the engagement's more important than the number of followers. Like, how engaged are they? You can have a million of followers. If they're not engaged, there's no real value there. And Wes, you mentioned UFC. I think Dana White's just done an absolute phenomenal job with that, whether it's your thing or not. His resilience is just phenomenal. I don't know if you heard him speak. He's just a machine. And Gary Brecker's changed his Dana White's life by helping him with his health and wellness, and just turned him into a monster. So he's quite the machine. But from an entrepreneurial perspective, seeing how he's done that and what he's overcome, and that just resilience of just going again and again and again, trying to put something in action that nobody wanted, and he's turned it into this massive global empire, and hyper fans, people who love it just are absolutely sold on it.
He's just there's some controversy this week on the Twitterverse. He walked out of an interview. He said he's done. He hit the wall. I saw Jordan Peterson on Twitter reach out to him saying, "Hey man, I know how you feel." So it might be a moment with regards to Dana. He might have maxed himself and might need a little break himself, actually. But he's, like you said, Mark, he's done a phenomenal job with what he's evolved UFC. I mean, the new, you know, even he's got all the fighters in the movies. Like Conor McGregor is going to be, he's in the new round, you know, Roadhouse. Remember the old Patrick Swayze? So Conor McGregor's the crim, you know.
make a good crim.
Yeah. Hopefully he got some acting lessons.
I don't think you'll see Conor be any different to any time you've ever seen Conor personally. The whole thing's an act. Yeah. All right, let's look at a different topic, right? One that'll be much, much dearer to Mark's heart. Qantas. by the way, if you're enjoying this, I need you to do a couple of things. Hit the like button. I need you to hit subscribe and the bell. Then you'll get notifications when these two great gentlemen come back online. Qantas, right? They, you know, obviously they've had their fair share of turmoil in the last little while, you know, and so separating the, you know, the COVID shutdown, because they all airlines had that, they just decided on top of that to make a couple of fundamental errors, like no one had their bags. Like that's a bit of an issue. and then the little leprechaun that ran the business, he stood aside. Now the question is, can Hudson turn Qantas around? Obviously it was never going to be a guess that they were going to try and appoint a female. That's how you get your funding. And so here's the question. Like, what is it? I mean, people forget, right? You can have a brand that is an absolute disaster, and 10 years later, if they fight through, it's totally fine. So the question is not, can Qantas come back? But where did it go so wrong? And what do you think they have to do from here if they want to turn this damage around in the shortest possible time and go back to war for seats?
Yeah, it's a big question. I think it does relate to what we were previously talking about as far as how important it is to manage your media and your social media in particular, and how, in this case, I think unions and social media just really went after Qantas. Whether that was justified or not, I mean, that's up for debate, I think. But I know Joyce used to check things twice to be sure. I tend to fly Virgin. I haven't been much of a Qantas fan. You know, there's no I in team and there's no U in Qantas. And so it's not my natural brand. And I particularly took some offense on their very overt way of engaging with the gay marriage debate. And for me, I don't think corporates should be choosing sides in massive social issues, because they're divisive, and half your team is not going to agree, and half is going to be excited by it. And I think that's divisive for culture within large organisations. So my take on that is stay away from social issues. Alan Joyce, I actually heard him speak live. Very sharp guy, super smart. Did a great job, particularly during COVID. I mean, they were gone. They were just in absolute trouble, like most airlines around the world. And he managed through that in an extraordinary way. So, you know, hats off to the way he did that. And at the end of this time, he has literally disappeared. He's missing in action. And if I was him, I'd probably be with him. Like, just not coming back to engage in any of this bun fight. So, you know, Hudson's got a massive job in front of it. There's no doubt about that. I think the unraveling, there are definitely two sides to that story. Did they go after profitability over customer service? Probably. Were there inherent systemic issues across airline industries? You know, post-COVID, absolutely. Like getting enough staff. Unions were being quite aggressive. But my trouble with this whole debate around airlines is, you couldn't get a more predictable business. You've got, you know, where people are going to be, when they're going to be there, what resources they're going to need. There's almost total transparency on everything. And yet we all wait 2 hours, everything's being delayed, they lose your luggage, and there has to be a better way to do this. The technology, for instance, you could literally walk from your car to a plane and just walk on and sit down, and everything that they do that takes 2 hours at the moment, you could actually do physically do as you're sort of walking through, going through scanners and things. So it's, I think it's ripe, the area is ripe for disruption. Very few people have made money out of airlines. They all tend to be government subsidised. It's a tough game, lots of stakeholders. I think overall for me, Joyce did a great job from a corporate perspective. But all I see at the moment, Virgin came out with, because their CEO's resigned as well, so they've got a new CEO. All the messaging on both lots of media at the moment around Qantas is how they're going to get back to making more money. And Virgin went into profit, but now it's all about shareholder value. None of them were mentioning anything about the customer experience.
Totally, yeah.
We've just missed this whole thing. It's all about creating an experience for people, moving them from one city to another. We should be thinking, they should really be thinking, if they want the brand to grow, they've really got to get customer-centric, genuinely customer-centric. And ultimately, if you do that well, you get the bottom line can improve.
If you look at pre-COVID, there was a massive war on, right, for the business seats and between Virgin and Qantas. They were like that had been a price war and a good level of competition that had been running for 6 or 7 years, and by all metrics, Virgin were winning, like the war on seats, and then obviously they got taken out, which is a shame because I think the minute Qantas were kind of put back on top, prices went really high and stayed there. And that level of competition is out. One of the things that I guess annoys me about, a couple of things about Joyce. One, I loved it when he stood toe to toe with the unions and grounded the fleet for 3 days and would not be manipulated. I think that was incredibly noble, and brave, great for his own personal brand around the world. And just good for Australia that, somebody just give it to the unions for a while. That's one thing I liked, but I hated, and it's the game, so it's not illegal, but, so they were always the newest fleet in the sky, right? That's their brand, has been their brand for decades, and they're now the oldest. Why? Because he refused to spend any money on fleet to get his profitability up so that his options at the end were worth more money, so he got his $27 million payout, right? That bit annoys me because, that's the ultimate self-interest. Having said that, now that I've said it, it's probably the way the board structured the payout. Like they probably could have engineered a completely different way of doing this. But to your point, Mark, I don't know that anybody's looking through this through the lenses of the customer. Like Virgin are going to do an IPO later this year. That's the plan. There's the food in the lounge is atrocious compared to what it was like, right? Yep. Because it's just bottom line, get it on the stock market, get our money back out, Bain Capital, and go do it again somewhere around the world. It's but the company that's going to do well here is the one that goes, let's lose a little bit in the short term. Let's invest in customer experience in a big way. And they'll be the ones that go to the bank for the next decade. David, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I'm a card-carrying Qantas member. And I made that call after being just disappointed, across the board, but with so many cancelled flights, I just went, it was a business decision for me. I didn't like a lot of what both you and Mark have just outlined in Qantas. The thing that I went for was, I pay a little more for the ticket, but the cancellation of flights is not as strong as in some of the other airlines. And I'd rather pay extra and get there than, be pushed back a couple of hours. So, but I see the same thing that both of you are saying there. I do feel the Qantas experience as a customer. The business lounge is crackers and water. It's definitely all that. There's a lot of, I'm spammed with emails from them about how they're doing, how they're really, focusing towards the customer experience. I can't say that I've felt it over the last 24 months yet. So I'm waiting for the experience to match the rhetoric. But I just think it's tough when you've got publicly listed companies and a board that, of course, is very focused on shareholder return and profit margins. And so to be front-facing to your client, it takes more than the CEO. I think it takes the board. It has to be a strategy that the board reconciles, I think what one of you said was, is if you do take care of the customer and do good, you know, the profitability will come. And like you said, these are, most of these airlines are subsidized. So it's not like they don't have the capacity to do that. The government will give them a cushion to make sure this happens, you know.
To the tune of $800 million when it came to the COVID payout for Qantas. Mm. I think that was the number, give or take 10 million maybe.
I do coach some businesses in the industry, service businesses, mm-hmm. to the industry, and I can't disclose who they are. What they have said is that post COVID, pre COVID, the airline industry, and I'm sure it had been for many years, was very brutal, very Babylonian. Post COVID, it took a hit for them, and they've been a bit more collaborative with their suppliers. Don't squeeze them quite as hard, and are actually easier to deal with. Now, will that remain that way? Maybe, maybe not. Again, the fundamentals, I think, probably would say no. As the nature of it is, they'll begin to squeeze down again. But they're also, like Mark said, they're in a situation where the technology that's coming through is disruptive. That walkthrough scenario is happening in Dubai Airport. I was actually in Canada. Coming to the States, and it's there as well. It was in Vancouver Airport as well, so it's coming.
For sure. Just a quick comment, Wes, if I may, around public companies. I ran a public company in New Zealand, a small one, and you have a lot of extra stakeholders that you don't normally have in private companies, particularly a lot more media attention, even for a small, medium cap ticket if you're doing something different. Bad news and good news goes a long way. Like, you got to be really careful on those things. But the pressure on the, particularly in the US with the quarterly, you know, the emphasis on the quarterly returns, you're incentivized on short-term metrics only. Like, they really don't care what the business looks like in 5 years' time, genuinely. It's about next quarter. You just have to, you're actually unraveling things that you know will grow medium-term wealth and health for the organization. If you're not hitting those short term numbers, you can't do it. You have to pull that investment out and make sure you hit the short term results. So there's a lot of pressure on the short term rather than thinking medium term. And I'm not sure there's an easy way out of that cycle, because it's very real, and big bonuses at stake for CEOs.
You know, I think one of the biggest blessings and opportunities for a private business is exactly that. You know, like, because I think a lot of people put the listed companies up on a pedestal, not knowing that they are beholden to a very different, you know, set of matrix to a private business that can just decide, okay, well, let's not make a profit for 2 years and let's be seven times the size. And people listening to this right now, like Mark's saying, when you're driven by short-term outcomes, you will have to hamstring the future, the mid or long-term of your business. And so, because there would be people listening to this with a small business who are like, I don't care. I just need to extrapolate as much money out of my business in February as I can. It's like, yeah, but as long as you think like that, you cannot build a much bigger one in February 2027. So I think that one of the things that makes private business more attractive and more competitive is that we don't have to play that game. We can just decide, well, I'm going to plow all my profits for 2024 back into the business and scale it. And I personally think that that's one of the joys of being able to run a private business. Staying in aviation just for fun, right? We've got 27 million people. We have Qantas, we have Virgin, we have Jetstar, we have Rex, we have Bonza. Which two fail is my question for you boys.
Well, I think we should get Qatar Airways in there as well, shouldn't we, Wes?
Maybe. They're edging in.
They should say yes to that. Cut price airlines are always really, really hard to do well. You get the odd example, like Ryanair smashed it because they not only, it wasn't just cheap, it was the experience. Southwest Airlines in the US, the same thing. Got this culture, there's got this whole experience, people queuing up. to enjoy the experience as well as get a cheap flight. So I think those that really genuinely engage in the customer experience as well as the price point will be the ones that win.
So Bonza, yeah. I haven't flown Bonza, but it's all budgie smugglers and she'll be right, mate, and all of that in their marketing.
Sounds terrible.
It does. And so what you'll get is, you know, they may as well call it Backpacker Airlines because that's who's going there. Rex is the only airline in Australia that have been profitable every year since they started because they went the regional routes and they had the cheaper planes and they charged a massive premium. But now they've taken on the triangle, right? Sydney, yeah, Brisbane, yeah. Melbourne, which is the most busiest triangle in the world. They bought a lot of the Virgin planes and stuff. They're going to give it a nudge. They've got the worst website in the history of websites to buy to buy your ticket from. So that's going to hold them back. But like, so I think Bonza is owned by Capital Seven Partners, right? Which is a venture capital firm that buy airlines. Because I think they're the same mob that did Spirit in America. And if you've ever flown Spirit, you'll know that I don't know what Spirit it is, but it ain't the Holy Spirit. That thing is the worst. I had to do it at the end of last year on a flight to Nashville because one
guy, Nashville.
I had a deadline. I had to get on a Spirit Airlines and I was like, I feel like the Lord has taken his favor off my life on this place. I'll just give you a funny story because people are listening, right? So I get on the plane. It's like midnight or whatever, and I've got a 4.5 hour direct flight to Nashville, and I'm already cranky because I had to stop at, you know, Auckland, and so it's been a long journey. And I get on the plane, and I smell this putrid smell. Brand new plane, actually, brand new. And I'm like, this is disgusting. Anyway, I realize that behind me, in America, you're allowed to take like a little comfort dog when you fly. So the people behind me had one little dog each, and they'd opened a tin of dog food and just put it on the floor in the plane, in the row behind me. And I'm like, I had a hoodie on, and I'm just like trying to tie the hoodie up like so that I can just like breathe. It was foul. It was absolutely foul. And anyway, like I said, I don't know what Spirit it was, but it was a demonic one. So we just don't have enough of a population to justify that many airlines, in my opinion. What do you guys reckon? Do you reckon it can work?
I do think Rex is the up and coming. I remember jumping on a plane on a Rex flight from Adelaide to the Kangaroo Island there. It's literally a 45-minute flight, and the plane was it was an old plane for Rex. It was like 12 seats. And the one stewardess, the curtain was between us and the pilot, and the stewardess is up doing the safety briefing, and the bloke, I wasn't paying attention, and the bloke next to me goes, Dave, listen to this? And I said to him, in the armrest, there's still ashtrays in this plane. I said, mate, if there's any trouble, I said, we're all dead. I said, forget getting your life jacket. We're all dead. But then I saw coming out of COVID, I saw them get support from the government, take advantage of the fleet that was available through the Virgin stumble. And I've got to say to you, I'm a Qantas guy, but I would definitely go the Rex route regional wise. And I think that they can make a strong case for it. I'm just not a fan of the Bonzas, and remember it was Tiger Air. When all you're doing is cheap tickets, and like Mark said, there's nothing else. There's no experience around it. That's a journey to the bottom, and you're out. You know, there's a death sentence to the business straight away. So I don't know. Can another player come in?
Yeah, I mean, because to Mark's point about Ryanair. And EasyJet would be another one that actually has been able to pull it off, but they did most of their income from their TV show. So they filmed the debacle and made it a TV show. But you got to remember, like their airline operated in amongst 250 million people with a geographical location nearer than Brisbane and Sydney. Yeah. Like, you know, it's much harder to do something the size of Australia with 1/10 of the population and get it to work. So I've got some fun bets going on with some of my friends that are interested in aviation, and we're down to like 18 more months before they pack up their bags and leave.
They are brutal. They are brutal markets. Look, I'm not sure on my take. I tend to avoid economy airlines whenever possible. Disappointed with the way Virgin's gone. They've definitely deteriorated. I was a bit of a big fan. Mind you, my best strategic move around Virgin was when COVID hit. I had a gazillion points and I thought, oh, $4 billion worth of debt and no flying, that's not going to end well. So I exchanged all my points for wine early on in the process. I managed to get them all out. I've got a fridge full of wine that's too expensive to drink. So it's...
You've been taking communion 3 times a day from then to now.
Yes. I keep looking at them going, that's nice, but when am I going to get a chance to drink them? They're nice bottles of wine.
Funny, I haven't seen that invite come through. Let me just
come visit.
No, it's still not there. Still not there.
I do check it every day. From now, man, come and stay. You'd be most welcome.
I've got one more topic I want to run by you guys, which I think will be fun. The commercial property sector. Obviously, you know, COVID put a massive dent in that. Rather than look backwards, I want to look forwards. I just pulled up a headline. So GPT, nothing to do with the AI tool. This is a group. This is a real estate group. They swing to a $240 million annual loss with commercial values as commercial values cool. Specifically, they're in the offices and the warehouses and the industrial sectors. I rent an office. It's a cool spot. What's the future for the commercial space? Does this turn around anytime soon? And what are you seeing as the trends?
Big question. So you actually got a couple of different topics there. Industrial land is very different to commercial land right now. So warehouses, the available to lease is like virtually zero. You just can't get stuff. So it's 0.0% vacancy rates. Whereas definitely what you're seeing is lower grade, mid-tier commercial buildings, particularly CBD type office space. There's a lot of vacancies. So you've got two very different markets. So I think industrial is super, super strong. I work with people in that space, and it's just really hard to make those things work if you need the space. It's expensive space. Commercial, we're right in the middle of, do we get everyone to come back into the office or not? Probably complicated a little bit by the big four. I mean, if you go down to Barangaroo, look at the names on buildings, all the big consulting companies, and they've shot themselves in the foot with gouging and not being as ethical as perhaps they could be with government. So, a lot of them haven't come back, and those that have, their work's dropped by 30%. So you got a lot of things happening, a lot of complexity in the ecosystem. I think the most fascinating question around that is the should everyone come back to the office?
I love Elon Musk's take on that, because he's not one to shy away from a little bit of controversy.
No.
I remember this might be 12 months ago now. He says to that he get does a town hall, like a virtual town hall with the whole company, and he says, I don't mind if you want to work from home. Like, it is totally okay to work from home. You just also have to work in the office for 40 hours a week. I like that. You can work from home, but you're here for 40 hours and then you do whatever you want outside of that.
Says the guy that, Elon Musk, that sleeps under his desk, under his office desk, doesn't even go home some nights, So, my wife actually works for a large Australian company who was all office based, and COVID, sent them home, got them all set up, and they've got all these buildings, big company. I'm not going to tell you, it's an RMA, big company. And they've got this building that we live on the Central Coast, this massive building, usually would have about 80, 90 people in it. And two people turn up. One person turns up because they don't want to work from home, and the second person turns up because from an OH&S perspective, you can't have just one person in the building. So they're literally turning the lights on of this big office building for two people that turn up. And I think the latest development is Now they've asked the staff just to come in one day a month as a bit of a team building camaraderie day. One day a month. That's it. So that's the current state of play. And I'm just like, wow, that's a lot of capital to as a company to be holding and burning the candle for. So this moving forward, what will happen? I mean, even in the local area here, big company ING have just built this multi-story. Now they planned that, built that before COVID. But it was empty during COVID, and now they're trying to fill it. But every time I drive past, you know, full glass walls, 10% maybe, yeah. 10% full. I just don't know how that makes commercial sense at all.
So what I'm hearing you boys say is we should have started a shop fitting business so that, you know, because the play here, right, is to take the big offices and they're chunking them down into much smaller ones.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't actually know where the numbers are, but there is a massive demand for the 250 to 500 square meters. Right? Because the big players are coming down to that amount, and then some businesses that are doing well are jumping up to that amount, right? So the places that were really quick to chop theirs into lots of little places, they're managing to get by. But the ones who are just like out there hoping for another government, you know, thing or a big business to sign up, like that's really tough. So here's the question though, and I reckon this is an interesting one because I've got some pretty firm views on this, but are we more collaborative working from home, or are we more collaborative when we work together?
Yeah, I think that's the it's pretty self-evident. You put people in a room, they're going to connect more than they do online. And I'm actually quite a fan of the whole work from home piece. I know after COVID, all my business leaders that I work with are right, everyone back in the office, and everyone's going, well, do we really want to come in? No, I don't quite like this new setup. And people's teams started voting with their feet. Employees started voting with their feet. They want more flexible. In general, they want a more flexible environment. The downside with that is what you're saying, is if you want creativity and connection, you've really got to be in the same room. And some companies are working their way through that by saying everybody needs to be in the office, say, 2 days a week, everybody on the same day. So they're not rotating people around saying, okay, these guys on Monday, Tuesday, these on Wednesday, Thursday. They're saying, okay, Wednesday, Thursday, everybody's in the office. So they're just sort of creating this culture where, but it's a bad use of space, which you know, kind of gives us the same issue. You've got some big tech companies like Atlassian saying you've got to be in four times a year. That's it. So you just have to touch base basically and do your own thing. But they also have a culture of connection with tribes and guilds, and you know, if you're the same, they get people together offline, and there's a whole social connection and online social connection as well. So I think you can manage it, but the basis of your question I think was answered by Google. They did a bunch of research on it, and they actually want people in the office, and they did the research around the value of that. They found productivity at home or in the office was about the same, which I thought was an interesting outcome because that's not what they wanted to hear. But if you wanted to do anything creative or innovative, significantly less productive when you're working from home.
Yeah. I read a very similar report, Mark, from Apple that did the same. They said productivity from a remote workforce was on par, but the creative dimension fell off the cliff for them. And so they then had to rethink, not just bring people back, but what does that, it's not just bring them back and then get them to sit in a cubicle. Like, you're going to bring them back, that's fine, but figure out, you know, how are you going to now take advantage of the human connection? It's a little bit like when people said, oh, well, shopping centers are all dead because of the online. Well, you know, not so. The community village, that need to want to come and be in the midst of other people, I know I can buy that shirt online. You know, that's not the point. It's not why I go to the shopping center. I might still buy the shirt there. I'm there because I want to be in the midst of people. I want to drink coffee. I want to be in the buzz of that. And I think from a work performance perspective, especially that innovative, creative dimension, we're just, as human beings, we're not built for isolation. It's, you know, I know we're talking business. It's why you can't just click off for online church. You know, you just, there's something that happens when you're in the room that will not happen when you're not in the room with other people.
Yeah, you definitely get that. The challenge of passing on wisdom and knowledge and experience from the people that have been around for a while to the people that are coming through. Those are the water cooler conversations, the, hey, can you help me with this? Or how does that work? Or just being in an office and hearing the conversations of how people are dealing with things, you just lose that connection. So it's very hard to grow culture. And I think the other challenge is younger people coming through and all those sort of nuances around how you operate in any particular environment or industry. And you get that from just being around people who've done it before. And it's really hard to do that if you're in a remote environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all had to do it, right? We sent our teams home and then, I mean, we didn't actually send many people home. I was like, if I give them a dose of communism, it's going to be hard to get it back, right? So I just was pretty strict around not giving it out. But I had a team that were like, no, I want to be in the office, you know? And so we kind of worked mostly through, apart from those really strict, you know, few days that were hard. We would be nothing today if we were decentralized and remote, because the power here is, you know, I walk from one side of the office to the other and three people like, what do you think of that design? What do you think of that? Here, I just want to show you this one quick clip, right? And so much of the work is sorted in a 3 second, you know, it's like, what am I going to do on Zoom? Am I going to book a Friday catch up with all of that stuff and then just sit there? And it just cannot, in my opinion, be as valid as an ecosystem that's in a room. Like you said, the water cooler, the knowledge transfer meetings, the catch-ups, the Susie, how's your dog? You know, that stuff. Like, you're not going to be able to replace it online. I would even question the, you know, productivity was the same, but creativity fell down. How do you even separate those? Like, that's like saying, we never need to create. We can just produce. Well, hang on a minute. Like, you've got no business in like 12 months if you're just producing and not creating, right?
Watch the space though, Wes. I think there's legislation coming last week, I think it was. They've just had the bosses not allowed to hassle people at home. Well, where's the fun in that? I've always been, I totally agree with that. I've got a lot of business friends who are really annoyed by, but that team members can ignore them outside of our hours. It's always been my thing around protect those hours, you know, let people do their own thing outside of the work environment. So I think that's a good thing. But the Fair Work Commission's now looking at the whole question of the right to work, you know, how the human rights have gone from basic to, you know, blowing out, whatever you want. This is there a right to work from home? So if you can work from home, does an employee have the right to go, I don't want you to work from home, I want you to work in the office? They don't need legislation to enforce that, so the Fair Work Commission can actually produce their own set of rules around that, and we'd have to comply to that.
Well, you don't have to comply, because I also have a right to employ.
Take the fine or
just don't employ that person if they want to work from home.
Yeah.
But I think just to pick up on the legislation changes, to my understanding, the default is that you can't contact them, but you can certainly write that back into their employee contract. So, and then it becomes a bargain about whether they want to sign their contract, but you can certainly add that back in, right? Because there are certain businesses where you can't get away with that. Like, you know,
sure.
So, sure. So I think the baseline is that that's there, but you know, you can almost have an EBA on that where you just decide, yeah, well, I'm adding it back in for these roles because it's, you know, kind of important.
I remember when I signed the contract for the I was a manager in a multinational, and the contract read, your contract is for a minimum of 50 hours a week, a minimum, and whatever is reasonably required by the business from you. So it was like, you'll work no less than 50, but you'll work as many as, you know, your role requires you to deliver. So if that's 80 hours, then that's fine. And you're signing, it was a salary. So you're signing the salary based on whether you know, you're going to work 50 or 80. And that's just how that works. But I think we are in a different moment, I think, as well.
Yeah. I mean, 50 hours is cute, right? I had a part-time job too once. So, and then I became an adult. Any final comments on the trends there, and what's something that somebody listening to this can do? Like, what can they learn from that whole debate?
I think at the moment I've probably got a slightly different view on it to you, Wes, but I think at the moment entrepreneurs and business owners should probably tread a little wary or a little bit more aware of employees' a sense of well-being and what they want, what they would like. Unemployment is low. People are moving and they have options. Now, that's going to probably change over the next 12 months. Like that, I think we'll see unemployment arise a little bit. But at this point, there's a reasonably even playing field. And if you don't create an environment where people can do well and genuinely want to engage with the company and the productivity and engagement that comes from that, part of that is how do you treat them around the things that are important to them? If you're not aware of those things and you're not treating people differently, actually, I believe we should be all treated differently. Some people, they want to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It just engages them and they're just machines. Others, they have a lot of other things going on. They'll do a great job for you, but they want to turn up at this time and they want to finish at that time, and that's fine. So
It's fine as long as they don't want to be treated the same when it comes to promotions, right, and outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. And some do want that.
That's ambitious. The market. The market some will be don't. The market, yeah.
For sure. So I think managing each individual in your team differently, but genuinely trying to connect with them, what's important to them, what do they want, is a great way to create productivity engagement, even within a framework where they may not be working 100 hours a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think too, what I would just say, I mean, we talked about a lot from the airline industry and how the airlines are treating their customers, how, the changing workforce. I just come back to this thought. I know I speak to people all the time, kingdom people in the marketplace. And I just say, look, if you're a boss or a manager, you're a pastor. No, you don't have that title, but you have a duty of care to love the person well in front of you. That doesn't mean you burn your business so that everyone feels happy. I think there's a kingdom reality here. But I think a lot of the problems that we're finding is, of course, industry and business need an outcome to stay alive. Then you've got a very entitled, I think every generation feels some, they're banting on of some entitlement. But I think in the middle here, there is a balance of taking care of people well in a way that doesn't destroy business and actually honors whether it's a client or a work or an employee or the market, honors it well. And sometimes that can feel like, oh, well, I'm just being the nice guy, I'm going to get smashed. Well, it doesn't have to be that. I think there's a balance here with it.
Very good. A lot of wisdom in there. If you've enjoyed the episode, make sure you subscribe, hit the bell, and give me some sort of like. That would be amazing. Next time we get together, I'd love to talk about ESG, climate change, interest rates, the economy, and maybe Disney. I reckon Disney would be a good topic because that's a huge fail, right, in the last kind of 6 months. But possibly prior to that, one of the greatest, corporate CEOs of all time. Who knows? But we'll dig into some of that stuff as we go. Gentlemen, I so much appreciate your wisdom. You definitely, view things differently to me. That was why I wanted to get us on here to do this. And for our audience, do me a favor. What was the best thing that jumped out to you? What was said that was a real learning? Do me a favor. Put it in the comments wherever you are watching or listening. And if you want to, send it to me directly in a DM so that I can engage with you there. All right, that's the end of episode 1 of Check the News. We'll be back and do it again real soon.